Just an inquiry, have you both signed in?
Yes, Your Honor. I have, Your Honor.
Excellent, thank you. We're ready when you are.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Tate Westendorf with the Virginia Beach Public Defender's Office, here today advocating on behalf of Jordan D'Angelo Champion. There are two assignments of error before the court.
Do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Thank you for reminding me. Yes, sir, please. If I could, please reserve 3 minutes.
3 minutes, yes, sir.
Thank you. There are two assignments, granted assignments of error before the court. They both relate to the same subject, which is the admissibility of statements that Mr. Champion had made to two Virginia Beach detectives over the course of a six-hour-plus interrogation that took place ultimately towards the tail end of that interrogation. He made incriminating statements that ultimately led to him being convicted of first-degree murder, conspiracy, and use of a firearm, and the conviction of a felony. He received the maximum possible statutory punishment, life imprisonment plus 13 years. None of that sentence was suspended. The statements in this case, from my perspective, are inadmissible because they were not voluntary statements. That's really the heart of this appeal. Voluntariness is a legal standard. It's not factual. It's reviewed de novo by this court, and the Commonwealth bears the burden of proving that a statement was made voluntarily, as it's been defined by the U.S. Supreme Court, that it was a statement made unconstrained, that it was essentially free and unconstrained. It was born of free will of its maker. And so that's really, that's the posture we're in at this point. Can the Commonwealth meet that burden of proving the voluntariness of the statement? And on the record before the court, I would submit the answer is no. It's, of course, as the court's well aware, it's a totality of the circumstances evaluation. Both U.S. Supreme Court, Virginia appellate courts have thrown out a lot of factors for courts to consider. It's a non-exclusive list. I think a logical starting place for us in this case are personal characteristics of Mr. Champion. That's one of the things for a reviewing court to consider. Youth and experience with Miranda warnings, that sort of thing. The record in this case is that Mr. Champion was 20 years old at the time of the interrogation. He had no criminal record. He had no prior exposure to Miranda warnings. All of that came in through the cross-examination of the detective at the motion to suppress hearing. His father, Mr. Champion's father, the elder Mr. Champion, also testified at the motion to suppress. He testified that his son had been in special education classes throughout his schooling history.
Although legal questions are de novo, the underlying factual findings of the trial court do bind us, don't they?
That's accurate.
And so the general graduating from a Virginia public high school in a general track program, doesn't that kind of undermine the father's testimony if it doesn't outright reject it?
I don't know that I would agree with that. I still think it's a factor for the court to consider. Now, no single factor is dispositive, and obviously the trial court judge ultimately concluded that, standing alone anyway, didn't render this an involuntary statement. I still think it's a factor for the court to consider in its analysis at this stage in the game. Again, his father testified that he's somebody who was kind of slow on the uptake. He had a difficult time comprehending things. Things needed to be explained to him multiple times before he would fully grasp them. So we're dealing with an unsophisticated young man in this case. So that's where we're starting from. And then I think the second circumstance that's important for this court to consider is the manner in which the police arranged for Mr. Champion to be interviewed. Two detectives, Detective Cole and Detective Jones, both appeared at Mr. Champion's residence. It was unannounced. And they lied to him about the circumstances under which they wanted to talk to him. And I realize that's a strong word, but I think it's the appropriate word in this situation. The testimony that was acknowledged by both the detectives and was corroborated by Mr. Champion's father is that the detectives told Mr. Champion, we want to talk to you about some neighborhood fights that are going on, that sort of thing.
Well, on some level, isn't that true? Wasn't it a neighborhood fight that ended up with the shooting?
If it has a kernel of truth, it was a lie of omission. The fact of the matter was the investigation had already focused on Mr. Champion, and they acknowledged that. He was their primary suspect.
Well, right, but they don't say, we don't view you as a suspect. It's, we want to talk to you about fights in the neighborhood. That statement itself is true.
True in a very loose sense. I think it's a very incomplete statement.
What part of it is false?
What renders it false is the omissions included. It's without any context. It's not, we want to talk to you about fights involving Christopher Lee. We want to talk to you about a fight over a girl named Lala that ultimately resulted in somebody being shot. It was not anything like that. I think it was presented to him in a way that made the situation seem far more innocuous than what the reality was.
Well, when they questioned him, though, they did ask him questions about, general questions about the neighborhood.
There were some initial questions like that. He ultimately agrees to accompany them to the Detective Bureau. He's at no point after that released from custody. He remains in continuous custody from that point forward.
But he's not in custody.
Well, according to I should say this. He is never again. He never again returns home at that point where custody
he gets
occurs.
Arrested at some point.
Sure.
But he did voluntarily go down to the station to talk with the officers. Wasn't that part voluntary?
It was voluntary in the sense that they literally didn't throw him in handcuffs and drag him there. I think that it was predicated on falsehoods that were presented to him. Once he arrives at the Detective Bureau, they put him in the the interrogation room that's being monitored around, I think they said it was 6:22 p.m., the statements aren't made. The incriminating statements aren't until over 6 hours later, around 12:30 a.m.
Is the question of whether he's in custody not a factual one?
The question of when he becomes in custody?
Yes.
I think that's a factual question. Yes, I would agree with that.
And the trial court found he was, page 305 and 306 of the appendix, found he was not in custody until he was Mirandized.
Until, I think it was a little bit prior to him being Mirandized.
They say you're not going home.
Exactly.
For our purposes, at least for your two-step, it's not step two that he's in custody is what the trial court said.
That's what the trial court found. I would agree with that statement. Okay.
You did not explicitly challenge that, so isn't that binding on us as law of the case?
I think that that's a binding fact that's before the court. I can't dispute that. I don't think that that... I don't think that determines the outcome, the resolution of the appeal in any way, particularly when it comes to the voluntariness issue.
And I don't want to go too far, but for your two-step argument, for there to be a deliberate two-step process to violate someone's, essentially violate somebody's Miranda rights, they have to be entitled to hear the Miranda rights first, correct?
That's an accurate statement, yes.
If he's not in custody and that's binding on us, during the whole first step of your two-step process, he wasn't entitled to be Mirandized.
Sure.
Correct?
And I definitely will get to the second assignment of error. As far as, I'll say this, all right, so it wasn't illegal that they were questioning him. The trial court found he wasn't in custody, therefore we don't have a custodial interrogation situation. We're not, the detective's not obliged at that point in time to read the Miranda warnings to him. Just because it wasn't illegal at that point doesn't mean that it's not a factor for the court to consider in the totality of the circumstances. There are plenty of things. It might not have been illegal for the police to say that a SWAT team might invade your parents' home, but it's still a factor for the court to consider in the totality of the circumstances.
Well, and let's talk about the SWAT team.
Sure.
Because the reference to the SWAT team, at least from my reading of the record, it was basically, we're cutting you a break here because we could have gone in guns blazing with the SWAT team. We didn't do that. We showed you respect.
I disagree with that characterization of it. I think if you read, I know it's a 117-page transcript of the interrogation. There's also a video in the record. I'm sure. But I think what you're seeing at that point is when the comments about the SWAT team are made, and there's more than one comment from the detectives,
right,
and it comes from both detectives, at that point there's been over 5 hours of fruitless interrogation. And I'm paraphrasing, but it's Detective Cole who first makes the statement about the SWAT team, and the essence of the statement was, you know, we thought you were the kind of guy, based on your lack of prior record, who was going to be cooperative, and now we see you weren't that kind of guy. And, you know, we could have come in guns blazing with the dogs and the flash bang grenades and handcuffed your parents in the street, you know, but we showed you respect and we didn't do that. You know, maybe we made a mistake.
Right, but
we could have in
prior.
The past.
Well, But then you have, shortly thereafter, Detective Jones says, well, you know what, you know, it's getting real late. This has already dragged on a lot longer than we anticipated and what we wanted. Oh, and by the way, you know, you can own up and say the gun we recovered from the crime scene is the gun you used to shoot him, or I guess we're going to have to execute a search warrant at your parents' house, and it's going to take a few hours to get it, so, you know, we're probably going to have to wake him up. And I think you consider that statement in the context of the earlier statement about, hey, you know, we have the authority to handcuff your parents in the street and yank them out of their home and throw flashbang grenades. And that conjures up incredibly powerful imagery. It's difficult to imagine something that might conjure up more something more disturbing and more emotional than the prospect of your parents being yanked out of their home, humiliated in the street in front of their neighbors with flashbang grenades and dogs. So I think if you consider the totality of the remarks made to him, I would suggest it would clearly be a threat or be reasonably perceived as a threat by Mr. Champion.
Does it become a threat if it's something that the police can accurately do?
I don't know that the police would have had the authority to do what's being described.
To get a search warrant?
Sure, they could get a search warrant. Whether that would entitle them to go in with flashbang grenades and dogs and a SWAT team might be an entirely different story when there's no reason to believe his parents pose any danger. Certainly nothing in the record that would suggest that.
Well, right, but that's why the temporal nature of the statement, we could have gotten you out of the house with flashbang grenades, taking everybody into custody till we identified who you were, is different. Because, as you've conceded, they already worked him up and were pretty confident he was a suspect, probably
True.
Could have gotten an arrest warrant for him before he...
But the earlier statement wasn't just conditional to Mr. Champion. There was the comment made, we could have pulled your parents out of the house and put them in handcuffs. His parents were specifically referenced, and his parents are still in the house at that point. So he has good reason to fear for his parents. And I think it's also important that these statements are made to him after continuous interrogation for over 5 hours. And I think it's important to actually view the video in addition to the written transcript. Now, the written transcript includes plenty of his head is in his hands, he's unresponsive, he's not responding, and that's a continuous, there's dozens of examples of that. But if you watch the video, you'll see that it depicts somebody who is, I would characterize it as psychologically beaten down. This is somebody who is, you know, appears listless, he's almost limp, his head is hanging, he's no longer speaking. And again, this is over an interrogation that's extending into the wee hours of the morning. And by the time the comments about the SWAT team are made to him, I would suggest his will has already been overborne, and the comment about the SWAT team really is sort of the nail in the coffin. That's the straw that broke the camel's back, and shortly thereafter, he's spilling his guts about, I was the guy who shot him, and I've got the gun.
But never spills his guts about Lala.
No, Lala escaped through the entire thing.
Which doesn't that, and the Commonwealth Brief points out that he was able to, his will was not overborne regarding that, which ultimately seems to have been true as well.
I suppose that's true. For whatever reason, his will when it came to Lala was stronger than his will for his own self-interest.
Chivalry?
Perhaps so. But again, I think that there's, when you consider the totality of the circumstances, there's an awful lot for the Commonwealth to overcome. And again, it is their burden to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that this was a voluntary statement.
Just so you're aware, you're rebuttal.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. Just moving on briefly to the second assignment of error, and I appreciate the comments that Your Honor made earlier with respect to the factual finding that was made by the trial court. I still believe the circumstances there are relevant to the voluntariness analysis in this case. When the police first encounter him, he's never advised that he's a suspect. He's never advised that an attorney might be relevant to his circumstances. He has no good reason to believe an attorney might be necessary because it's presented to him in a rather innocuous manner that, hey, it's just neighborhood fights. It's minimized. The Miranda rights, again, are not read to him, albeit the trial court found that they were not required to be read to him at the initial phase of the interrogation, but they're not read to him until over an hour into the interrogation. When they are read to him, again, I would characterize it as minimizing the significance of the rights. It's presented to him as something that's rather perfunctory, that it's a bureaucratic formality. We got to do it. It's something we got to do real quick. And his only affirmation that he understood was, mm-hmm, that's it.
But they took time. The video shows that they actually took time. They may have used the terminology real quick, but, I mean, they went into some length to make sure that he understood.
I would not use some length. It was all read to him consecutively, maybe 30 seconds, and that was the full extent of any conversation with respect to Miranda. But I'll wait for any rebuttal.
Okay. There'll be precious little, but that's fine. Mr. Katz.
Good morning. I'm Benjamin Katz, appearing on behalf of the Commonwealth. The defendant on appeal lays out serially the circumstances that this court ought to look at in determining whether the waiver was in fact voluntary. However, as to each argument he makes, he fails to view that evidence in a light most favorable to the Commonwealth, as this court must on appeal. He presents to this court a relatively unsophisticated defendant who he argues was overwhelmed by this process. And I would submit that the factual record, viewed in the appropriate light on appeal, fails to support that characterization of the defendant. Judge Russell, as you pointed out, and as I argued on brief, if the argument is this gentleman's will was overborne and that his self-determination was critically impaired when he made the statements to police, he was remarkably successful in refusing to give the police the information they did not possess. The only thing he gave the police was information they confirmed that they knew already. So if we are to believe that this is a gentleman who's simply overwhelmed by the process, he's spectacularly lucky. Or, in fact, he was not overwhelmed. He was very careful about what he gave the police, and it was only to confirm what they already knew. Similarly, the argument that this gentleman was somehow not educated enough or not sophisticated enough is belied by the testimony of his father, specifically with respect to his education, but also with respect to the conversation they had on the night of the interrogation, where the defendant conveys to him, look, I admitted I did it. I know what I'm doing. And there's no contemporaneous suggestion that he somehow was overwhelmed by the process or that he didn't understand the process that was going on. This is evidence in the record that demonstrates this individual understood perfectly clear what was happening. And I think a reasonable inference is that he was doing so to shield either his cousin or Lala or persons yet unknown who were responsible for arranging the ambush of Mr. Lee, making sure that he would be there. I think that is an inference that flows from this evidence. And so,
does the law permit law enforcement to essentially, I won't use the word lie, but mischaracterize things to a suspect prior to advising them of Miranda?
Well, I think specific to this case, that did not occur. And so it's not necessary for this court to address in a vacuum the permissibility or the impermissibility of doing so. I think what we have in this case is the general statement, we want to talk to you about what's going on in the neighborhood. And the facts that they had developed prior to bringing him in suggested that the death of Lee was as a result of a quote-unquote beef between two groups, the participants of which they had identified through other sources. They knew that Mr. Champion was one of them, and they were trying to figure out, well, why did that happen, and what was your specific role? And so certainly they're not obligated when they show up at his house to say, hey, would you like to come with us? Because we want to ask you A, B, C, and D, the answer to which may incriminate you. But clearly they gave him a general idea of, we want to talk to you about what's going on in the neighborhood. And I think the record indicates that Mr. Champion had talked to the individuals who had already talked to the police. He was well aware of the circumstances about which they wanted to talk to him about, and admitted that he knew of the death of Lee. I think the record indicates he had spoken to those individuals before he ended up in interrogation, which I think demonstrates why he was hesitant to give them more than they knew. I think he was aware of what the police knew. So I would reject the argument that this is an individual who is unsophisticated and is overborne by the process of talking to the police. I think the record indicates quite the opposite, actually.
What about the threat of the SWAT team?
Well, as I lay out on brief, and as I think the court's questions indicated, it's simply incorrect. It's a misreading of the factual record to suggest that he was threatened with the SWAT team, and the timing fails to bear that out. I think, as Your Honor indicated in her question, it is a reference to past events to say we could have done this, but we treated you as a gentleman and we did not do this. The argument on brief is the later suggestion of having his parents in the street in handcuffs is what precipitates the confession. And I would submit that that's incorrect in light of the record. The process of the interrogation is Champion making false statements about his telephone records. And then when the police reveal, well, that's incorrect, and we know that's incorrect, and here are the records, it's at that point that he realizes, well, this line is unsustainable, and now I need to tell them something else. This is not a reaction to, my parents are going to be in the street in handcuffs. That's simply not what happened, and the record fails to support that. And I think it's a stretch to suggest otherwise. Similarly, as Your Honor, Judge Russell indicated, there is an unchallenged finding as to the fact that Champion was not in custody prior to the time the officers indicated, you're not leaving tonight.
Me ask you a question about whether it's truly unchallenged. Although there's no express challenge to it, both assignments of error are sort of a violation of Miranda. Given that Miranda only applies in custodial interrogations, why isn't it implicitly challenged?
Well, I would suggest respectfully, Your Honor, that the assignment of error is that the execution of rights under Miranda was not knowing, intelligent, and voluntary. And that is not an assignment of error as to when the timing compelled it. It's as to the substance when it was given, what the circumstances were at that point. And I would argue that those are two very different assignments of error, and it would be incorrect to conflate one with the other. I think specificity is required to say, this is the error the trial court made. This is what I intend to focus on before the Court of Appeals. And it would be improper to allow that to mushroom to a somewhat related but specifically different issue. And so I would argue that it has not been presented, it has not been challenged. And I think it does get to the attempt to apply Seibert under these facts, because there's simply no question-first, clean-up-later approach taken by the police. And moreover, I think on appeal, the defendant applies the incorrect standard of Seibert as it has been narrowed by this court in Kuhn. There's simply no deliberate effort by the police, which is supported by the fact that the finding that he was not in custody prior to that time.
And on the question, on the Kuhn question of deliberateness, that's a requirement. Is deliberateness a question of law or a question of fact?
I think it has to be a question. Well, there is the initial question of fact as to whether the police engaged in deliberate efforts, and that's a question of fact the trial court makes. And then I think this court, it's a mixed question by the time this court is trying to apply. But clearly, deliberateness itself, standing alone, is a fact question for the trial court.
On page 32 of appellant's brief, he concedes that the trial court did not make an explicit factual finding of deliberateness. Is that fatal to a two-step claim? If the trial court doesn't make the ruling, and therefore we're stuck looking at the evidence in the light most favorable, I mean, do you automatically win that because there's no express finding of deliberateness, or can we still raise the question?
Well, I think as I argued on brief, the finding is implicit. I think this court, again, this court is going to review de novo the application of law to facts that I argue were implicitly made, or the court can reasonably infer that those facts are made.
Well, if both of you could make that argument, do you necessarily win because you won below?
It is tempting to make that argument, Your Honor. I wouldn't quite go that far, but I think it is certainly a circumstance for this court to consider as it applies the laws to the circumstances below. And we have clearly the finding that he was not in custody prior to that time. That is a fact that has been made. And so as this court seeks to determine whether there was an implication that there was no deliberate action, we don't have a specific finding from the trial court, but I think implicit in the trial court's finding, it wasn't necessary. I think it flows from that. It reasonably flows from that evidence. And so I think the court can credit that as it applies the law as to whether the trial court erred as a matter of law. I hope that answers Your Honor's question.
It does.
I have made the specific arguments I'd like to make today. I want to give the court an opportunity if it has any follow-up questions so that I can address them now.
Hearing none, I think we're fine.
I would ask the court to affirm the judgment below. Thank you.
Very well, thank you. Mr. Westendorf, you've used your time, but we'll put a minute on the clock there for you if that's useful to you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. As far as whether this was a deliberate two-step interrogation technique, I don't think that's crucial to the resolution of this appeal, whether it's Seibert or Elstad. Elstad requires you go back to the voluntariness standard. And I think that, again, is really the heart of this appeal. And you've got a number of factors in the totality of the circumstances that would indicate this was not a voluntary statement made to the police. You have, again, I would characterize it as the threat made against Mr. Champion's family. I think that a reasonable person in his position would have interpreted it as a threat, and I think kind of the proof is in the pudding. It worked shortly after the statement about the SWAT team is made, and this is after over five prior hours of fruitless interrogation. Shortly after the SWAT team comments are made, he capitulates and he confesses to his involvement. Again, the comments, the incriminating statements, are ultimately made after he's been continuously questioned for over 6 hours. Continuously, that's not including the time spent at his house or being transported to the detective bureau. Again, I think the video depicts a young man who's limp, unresponsive, who's been psychologically beaten down at that point. Again, it's the Commonwealth's burden to prove voluntariness, and in this scenario, I would submit to the court that they cannot meet their burden, and for that reason, I would ask that you reverse his convictions and remand it to the trial court.
Very well, thank you. The case is submitted. We'll step down and greet counsel and then take up the last case on the docket, Benjamin Madonu versus the Commonwealth.